Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, who were the three peoples living in Judea at the time of Jesus, and what was the position of women in each of them? Richard Zimler is a best-selling novelist who specializes in historical fiction, generally with Jewish themes. He was born in New York in 1956. He earned a bachelor's degree in comparative religion from Duke University and a master's degree in journalism from Stanford University, and then worked for 8 years as a journalist, mainly in the San Francisco Bay Area. In 1990, he moved to Porto, Portugal, where he taught journalism for 16 years, first at the College of Journalism and later at the University of Porto. Richard has published 11 novels over the last 22 years, and his works have been translated into 23 languages. His novels have appeared on bestseller lists in 12 different countries, and 5 of his books have been nominated for the prestigious International Dublin Literary Award. Richard has won numerous awards for his work, including the Marquis de Oro Prize in 2010 for the Warsaw Anagrams, the 2009 Alberto Benveniste Prize in Fiction for Guardian of the Dawn, and the 1998 Herodotus Award for The Last Kabbalist of Lisbon. He was also granted a 1994 U.S. National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship in Fiction. In 2017, the city of Porto awarded Zimler its highest distinction, the Medal of Honor. Richard has also published 5 children's books in Portugal. One of them, The Dog Who Ate Raindrops, won the prize for Best Children's Book of 2018 from the Bisaya Barreto Foundation of Portugal. He writes his children's books in Portuguese and his novels in English. This week, Richard is speaking with us about his new novel, The Gospel According to Lazarus, which was published in the UK, Ireland, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand this past April, and will come out in America and Canada on July 1st.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Richard. This book, The Gospel According to Lazarus, I noticed was first published in Portuguese in 2016. Did you write it in Portuguese?
No, I wrote it in English. And the reason why it came out first in Portuguese, well, there's actually several reasons. The first is I live in Portugal and I've lived here for 30 years, so I have an excellent relationship with my Portuguese publisher. And my books always go to number one on the bestseller list here, so they're very keen to get them out as quickly as possible. In England and America, they are delayed usually because there's a time lapse between when I hand in the manuscript and when it gets published, because in America and England, they have to first get it into the catalog, do the copy editing. The process can take up to a year and a half usually. In this case, it got delayed even further because I had problems with my literary agent in New York. So all these different aspects combined together to make the book come out much earlier in Portugal.
The story is narrated by Lazarus, and it's centered pretty much on his relationship to Jesus, especially during the last week of Jesus' life. What motivated you to write about Lazarus?
The story of how I wrote this book goes back to the late 1980s. At the time, I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area. One of my brothers was living in New York and got ill with AIDS. At the time, as you know, and as your listeners will know, it was a death sentence. There were no drug cocktails, certainly no cure. And so I would have to travel to New York fairly frequently from California to talk with his doctors about getting medications and talk to AIDS researchers and buy food for his apartment and generally help him out. And it was the worst period of my life. I was very traumatized, especially when he died in May of 1989. He was only 35 years old, and when you love someone who dies young, it changes the course of your life forever. Let's just leave it at that. And soon after he died, I had this dream. And in the dream, I was in this large mansion. I must have been staying there. I was in one of the bedrooms. And I looked through the window, and outside on the patio was my brother. And in the dream, I thought, everything's different. He's come back to life. And I ran outside to greet him. And he recognized me, but he was diminished emotionally. He could feel misery and sadness and depression, but he couldn't feel happiness or joy, and he knew it, so it upset him even further. And at some point in the dream, he walked into the back, well, walked towards the back into an annex or carriage house of the mansion, and I knew not to follow him, and I didn't. And the dream came back to me a couple times over the next weeks, and then it disappeared, except that it came back 17 years later after the death of my mother. And this time, when I had the dream, as soon as I woke up, I thought immediately of Lazarus, for the obvious reason that both my brother and Lazarus come back to life. But there was a less obvious reason too, which I didn't realize until I started to research Lazarus's time and place, you know, the Holy Land 2,000 years ago, what daily life was like, what kind of clothes Lazarus would have worn, what he would have eaten, the politics of the time and place. And suddenly, at some point, I realized I had to make him the narrator of my new novel. And that's what I did. I told the story from his point of view and talked about early just Jewish mysticism. And as you mentioned, especially about the relationship between him and his beloved friend, Jesus Christ. St. John, who writes about Lazarus in his gospel, calls Lazarus Jesus's beloved friend.
I was going to get to that about the research, because you've written novels about different historical periods and places, and they're all very, very well researched. But there's a lot of documentation, for example, about the Inquisition and about the Holocaust. How did you go about doing research for this book, since this period, I assume, has fewer historical, proven historical documents available? And how long did it take you to actually write the book from the time you started doing the research?
Okay. I started the research by ordering everything that I could find about daily life in the Holy Land 2,000 years ago. And that meant reading, for instance, about the Roman Empire and trade along the Mediterranean, the Greek colonies that were then in the Holy Land. Of course, I had to do a lot of reading about early Jewish practice, the temple, which at the time, the temple in Jerusalem was the center of the Jewish religion. It obviously no longer is, because it was destroyed 2 times. So I did all the reading I could. I ordered about 40 different books. I read them. I took notes. And that took about 6 to 9 months. And then when I was finished with that, I started writing. And I knew the first chapter of the book would be Lazarus waking up in his tomb in Jerusalem and being disoriented and fragile, and not recognizing the people who were with him, and having to rediscover his life, rediscover who he was, and find a new identity for himself. And the writing itself took about 1.75 years. So I would say the whole project took me about 2.25 years.
Wow, I would have thought it would have taken you 10 years with the kind of research you must have had to do.
I'm getting pretty good at it. So, once I order the books and I start reading, I do it fairly efficiently. So 9 months was enough for the research on this one.
Obviously, much of what takes place in the story, such as the conversations, is fictionalized. But how much of what occurs is historically correct and how much is fiction? And I have some examples that I wanted to ask you about.
Right. I'll just generally speaking, the only one of the 4 accepted Orthodox Gospels that speaks about Lazarus and his resurrection is John. And so what I did is I tried to stick very close to John's timeline. His timeline is slightly different from the one in the other 3 Gospels. But I decided that since John mentions Lazarus, that was the one I was going to use. So I basically stuck with that. And the events that we all know from the New Testament, such as, Jesus chasing the merchants out of the outside court of the temple and riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. I have those things in the book because, according to John, that's what happened. I've obviously added other events that have to do specifically with the relationship between Lazarus and his best friend from childhood, Jesus.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Were they childhood friends? Were they lifelong friends? Or that's something you put in?
That's what I put in. But I think I did I did something rational, because what we know from St. John is that they were beloved friends. That's the word he uses, beloved. And we know that Jesus was also friends with Lazarus's 2 sisters. So using my novelist's mind, I made the logical extrapolation that if Jesus was great friends with Lazarus, and if he knew his two sisters, then they must have been friends from childhood. How else would he have known the whole family? And so that's the way it starts for me. They meet when they're 8 years old, and that part of the book is told in flashbacks. And they have a very strong influence on each other as kids. There's a scene, for instance, where Lazarus saves Jesus' life. And at that point, he is accepted into Jesus' family by his mother, Mary, and by his father, Joseph.
What about the attitudes, for example, of different groups towards each other? You mentioned the attitude of the Latinized Jews towards craftsmen, and you say they were one small step above brigands and bandits, for example.
Right. That's part of my research into Roman philosophy, Roman thinking, Roman daily life. They really did regard poverty as almost criminal, and people who worked with their hands were seen as almost beneath contempt. I mean, the Roman ideal was to be a patrician, to not work with your hands, to have slaves and servants do all that. So that part of the book is extremely accurate from all I've read about Rome and Roman daily life.
And that education for women was a birthright?
Well, that's interesting because there were three main peoples living in Judea and this area of the Holy Land at the time. There were the Jews, of course, and there were the Greeks. There were 10 Greek colonies, and there were the Romans, who were the conquerors. And from my research, I discovered that in Rome, women, at least at the middle class level, had a higher level of education, were allowed to travel alone, go out in the city alone, visit friends. They had a certain amount of autonomy that they did not have either in the Greek or in the Jewish community. In the Greek community, as a matter of fact, they were in many cases resigned to living at home and could only go out when accompanied by a male relative, by a husband, brother, father. Almost like we think of certain Arabic societies where the women live in compounds and only go out when they're permitted to do so. It seems to me that from my research that was pretty much the Greek way of doing things 2,000 years ago. In Judaism, at the time, they had a sort of a middle path between the Romans and the Greeks. Women would get an education, for instance, if there was no male child. And that actually is one of the tragedies in the book to Lazarus's sister, Martha, is that she was born before Lazarus and she and her sister started to get an education. But once the boy was born, all the attention in the family in terms of education was turned toward him. And so she's very resentful in the book, is very bitter about that. And it plays out in the relationship that she has with her brother Lazarus.
Do you think that any of this might have had something to do with what nowadays we might call more progressive Jews assimilating and the whole issue of assimilation, not assimilation?
Well, that's an interesting question because it was a multicultural society. And for instance, as you mentioned, there were Latinized Jews. There were Jews who'd either grown up in the Italian peninsula or in Rome itself or in a Roman colony. They spoke Latin. They adopted Latin ways. They ate Latin foods. They did not speak Aramaic. And so you have these people living in between worlds. They defined themselves as Jews, and yet they were very Roman in their day-to-day life. And I suspect, yes, what you're saying is that there were probably very different ways of approaching Judaism depending on where you were born and your station in life, and of course whether you were male or female. And that was one aspect of my research that really interested me a lot, the different layers of culture, the different layers of possibilities for people. And it's something that plays out in the book quite strongly, I think.
Yeah. There were also some examples of customs and beliefs. For example, you say that it was typical of Alexandrian Jews to use the term respectable citizens when talking about people.
Right. I use that because Alexandria, although it was in Egypt, of course, was a Greek city. It was founded after the Greeks had taken control of Egypt by Alexander the Great. It was the New York City of its era, of the ancient world. It had large avenues. It had the huge library. It had the lighthouse. It was very sophisticated, cosmopolitan, with peoples from all over North Africa and the Middle East and even from Europe. So it was the cosmopolitan place. And being of Greek culture, the idea of citizenship was extremely important to them, not just to the Greeks themselves, but of course to the Greek-oriented Jews and the other peoples.
And I found some other things just interesting that you could find this information. For example, you say, Lazarus says, in the Galilee, we believe that a hand facing down can block the growth of a child. I mean, where did you find these folk beliefs?
I got that from other cultures. There are other ancient cultures, particularly in Africa, where that is a common belief. And so I extrapolated. I never found that, I must admit, I never found that with regard to the Galilee, but I found that with regard to other ancient cultures, and I extrapolated the idea that perhaps it was common to many different peoples.
And the people from the Galilee are almost presented as being backward.
Well, they were regarded by the Judeans as like, bumbling hillbilly cousins, because the Galilee at the time was, you know, an agricultural center, more rural. And so the people in Jerusalem, who thought they were very sophisticated, right at the heart of Judaism, which of course they were since the temple was there, they regarded people from the Galilee as, you know, from the nether regions of Jewish control. And even worse were the Samaritans. They regarded the Samaritans as contemptuous because, for an interesting reason, the Jews of the Galilee and the Jews of Judea regarded the temple as the geographic center of Judaism. That's where their pilgrimages were to. That's where the sacrifices were made by the priests. It was the center of the cult, so to speak, the religious cult. But the Samaritans didn't. The Samaritans regarded a mountain as holy in their own territory, which was between Judea and the Galilee. And they would go up to the top of the mountain and do their prayers and their rituals there. So they were regarded by the Jews, particularly of Jerusalem, as fairly contemptuous.
Now, you mentioned Lazarus's sisters. How many of the secondary characters really existed?
Oh, let me think. I think most of them. Of course, Lazarus and his two sisters, I didn't make them up. Jesus is obviously a central character. His mother is there. His brother is there. We know all that from history. Jesus's followers, the apostles that I mentioned, you know, especially John, because I wanted to include him since it was his gospel that mentions Lazarus. He was real. You know, only some very minor characters in the book. Let me think. Lucius, the Latinized Jew, this Roman Jew, I made him up, but based very closely on historical precedents and the kind of Roman Jews that existed at the time. The children, obviously Lazarus' children, were my invention. And so, you know, there are a number of peripheral characters throughout the book that add to the quality of it being a historical novel about real people, about human beings and their difficulties and how they overcome them or don't overcome them.
Something else that I thought was impressive, something that impressed me, was your use of Aramaic, Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. How much did you have to study these languages to be able to use them in the book?
Well, that's part of my research. I make lists of words that may come in handy as I'm doing my reading. So if I find a very interesting Greek word, I write it down. If I find a term in Aramaic that seems very poetic and wonderful, I write it down. I don't have my notes in front of me, but I remember the Aramaic word for dawn. I thought just had a beautiful sound to it. So I used that. And there were certain other Greek words that just struck me as gorgeous. You know, that's part of the poetry of the book is a love of words. And that love of words, I transferred my own to Lazarus. Lazarus is a person who loves language. He's bilingual in Greek and Aramaic. And he just, he loves poetry. So that's, I guess that's part of me in the book.
And did he really have the profession that you talk about in the book?
No, there's no mention in the Gospel of John as to Lazarus's profession. In my book, he's a mosaic maker, which he both loves, and he has a love-hate relationship because he adores creating gorgeous, meaningful, symbolic mosaics. But for instance, he's ashamed of his hands. He has a laborer's coarse hands. And when he talks to someone from an upper class background, he tends to hide his hands behind his back, because his dream as a boy was to become a teacher, to really be a studious person. That got stopped when his father was murdered by a Roman. And so all his plans came to an end, and he ended up as a mosaic maker. So he loves his work, and yet at the same time, there's a part of him that wishes he had been able to become a real studious teacher.
Was his father murdered by a Roman?
Yes. Yes, in the book, there's a story.
No, I mean
about,
in real life. I mean really.
Oh, in real life. Sorry, no. Again, those sorts of details about Lazarus are all mine. We know very, very little from St. John. We know that Lazarus, for instance, got caught up in the plot to kill Jesus, because Jesus was using him to show the people that he was a very special spiritual being who could create these miracles. And so that part of the book is also based on St. John, the part where I don't want to do a spoiler, but towards the end of the book, Lazarus has to make a very difficult decision because his life comes under threat.
Now, you said that your books are always bestsellers in Portugal, which I think is fantastic. And
yeah,
this book gives a very unconventional take on the biblical story, as I'm sure our listeners know by now from our conversation. It's told from a very human point of view. And I was wondering, in a country like Portugal or in Brazil, for that matter, which are very Christian, how has the book been received? I mean, has it gotten any criticism for this?
In Portugal, no. I have to say that my readers in general are fairly sophisticated, sensitive people, and they love the book. I mean, one newspaper said this was my masterpiece, that this was the best book I'd ever written, and everybody had to read it. So that was a shock, and a wonderful shock. No, I did, you know, amazingly enough, I didn't get any harsh criticism in Portugal, but in Brazil, there are not necessarily, I don't think they were Catholics, but I would call them newborn fundamentalist Christians of an evangelical branch. And a few of them wrote, you know, like, this book must have been written by the devil or something, some crazy things like that. But, you know, that happens on Facebook because people feel freedom to insult other people they've never met. Mm-hmm. So I would say I got 3 or 4 brief messages, nothing intelligent, but, you know, this book was written by the devil or this is heresy or, you know, things like that that doesn't bother me. I did the best to be faithful to my vision of Jesus and my vision of Lazarus as Jews living in the Holy Land at that time.
Will there be a Spanish translation?
Gosh, I would hope so. But, you know, we haven't sold Spanish rights yet, so I'm waiting to hear about that. But I think this book would do extremely well in Spain, and I would love for there to be a Spanish translation. And I think it would do great in South America, too, you know, in Argentina, Mexico. I'd love it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The only thing I'd like to add is that part of what makes my version unconventional, as you were saying, and quite rightly, is that I've tried to give Lazarus and Jesus and the other characters, I tried to give them back their Judaism. So in my version, Jesus is referred to as Yeshua ben Yosef, Yeshua son of Yosef. And Lazarus is Eliezer ben Natan, Eliezer son of Natan. And because I thought that was really important, not just because it's true, I mean, Jesus was a Jewish mystic and healer, but because it freed me from Christian iconography. Once you give Jesus his Hebrew name, Yeshua ben Yosef, you're free to characterize him as something other than the vision that we have in TV programs about Jesus. And once you characterize Lazarus as Eliezer ben Natan, you're freed from any constraints that you may feel based on Christian iconography. So that was really important for me as the writer. And I've heard from readers that it's really important for them, that this book, in fact, they don't have any criticisms at all. In fact, they say that this book was liberating for them in terms of their vision of who Jesus was.
And what I'm going to say now, if you consider it a spoiler, we will cut it out, okay?
Sure.
What you just said is something that's reflected at the end of the book.
Right. Yeah, no need to, that's not a spoiler. That's absolutely true. I very much wanted to be consistent in that approach to Jesus and Lazarus as Jews and not as Christians. I have nothing against Christianity per se, but I wanted to give them back what they deserve. They deserve to be seen as, you know, Jesus deserves to be seen as the incredibly charismatic Jewish mystic and healer that he was. And that was part of my mission.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.